would start decompensating and have another issue. So I wanted my medication, which should have been the first response. I should have had that at the precinct. I should have been taken or call an ambulance or have me taken to the hospital.
Five Mualim Ak, who serves on Mayor de Blasio's task force on behavioral health and the criminal justice system, along with longtime Harlem activist Jazz Hayden and Terrence Slater. All three work with the group Incarcerated Nation Corp, known as INC. Their arrests on Tuesday night are now being investigated by the New York Police Department's Internal Affairs Bureau. We reached out to New York Mayor de Blasio's office for comment. In a statement, a spokesperson said, quote, "The administration's committed to increasing police transparency while ensuring our hard work officers can effectively perform their duties." And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Has three job openings. Check our website, democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Nermeen Sheikh, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Mass incarceration in the United States is due in part to the criminalization of people with drug addictions. Join me on Prison Pipeline March 21st to hear Leland Berger, an attorney who defends those charged with cannabis-related crimes. He'll discuss the recent legalization of marijuana and its effects on the criminal justice system here in Oregon. That's Prison Pipeline March 21st at 6:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of The Problem with Privilege, a four-week class hosted by the Portland Underground Grad School starting April 4th at 6:30 p.m. This class is for those who want to name and correct liberal racism, who want to understand and interrupt isms, and who want to be a powerful ally and take on race issues and white fragility without co-opting the issues. Again, that's The Problem with Privilege, a four-week class hosted by the Portland Underground Grad School starting April 4th at 6:30 p.m. at Hatch, 2420 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Information on how to register for the class and more can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. Are you on Instagram? So are we. Look up KBOO Radio, all one word, to find us and start following us for photos of the KBOO studios and beyond. On the KBOO Instagram, you'll be able to see live music performances, photos of our archived program guides, features on volunteers, and more.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a federal court has ruled that prison gerrymandering is unconstitutional.
The Supreme Court will not hear challenges to overturn Colorado's legal regulated marijuana program, which had been filed by the states of Nebraska and Oklahoma.
And researchers at OHSU have developed human antibodies that have the ability to eliminate the HIV virus from newborn monkeys.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 21st, 2016. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. A federal court has ruled that district maps for elected offices in Jefferson County, Florida, which included state prison inmates, illegally diluted the voting power of voters in the other districts. In an order issued in a lawsuit filed on behalf of residents of Jefferson County by the American Civil Liberties Union of Florida and the Florida Justice Institute, U.S. District Judge Mark E. Walker held that the practice known as prison gerrymandering violated the constitutional rights of Jefferson County residents. It's the first federal court in the country to issue such an opinion. Prison gerrymandering occurs when state and local governments include prisoners as residents in their redistricting plans for purposes of drawing their election lines in such a way that reduces the voting strength of actual residents in the area. The ruling found that inclusion of the large inmate population at Jefferson Correction Institute violates the one-person, one-vote provision of the U.S. Constitution's 14th Amendment. The order states that the county must submit a proposed map that complies with the ruling by April 4th, 2016. Otherwise, the court will draw its own interim plan.
According to a report released late last week, the state of Oregon brought in nearly $3.5 million in tax revenue in the first month of legal recreational marijuana sales. That means stores sold almost $14 million of marijuana to the non-medical market. Retail sale of non-medical marijuana through participating medical dispensaries has been legal since October of last year. Taxes began to be applied and collected on January 4th. February 29th was the deadline for retailers to remit the sales taxes they had collected during January. The Oregon Health Authority reports that there were a total of 309 dispensaries selling into the adult non-medical market in January. Only 253 tax payments for January were remitted to the Revenue Department, so it's possible that the total for the month will increase. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission, or OLCC, had originally estimated that recreational marijuana retail sales would raise only $10.7 million in the first year and a half. Dispensaries have until March 31st to remit the taxes they collected on non-medical retail sales during February.
The Washington State Democratic Caucus is coming up next Saturday, March 26th. So today, former President Bill Clinton's in town to promote his wife's presidential campaign at Clark College in Vancouver at 5 p.m. in the Student Union. It'll be his second appearance in Washington State after speaking earlier today at Spokane Falls Community College. Hillary Clinton's opponent Bernie Sanders drew thousands to Vancouver on Saturday. Clinton has twice as many delegates as Sanders, and there are 118 total delegates at stake in Saturday's caucus.
A somber gathering took place last week in Olympia, Washington. The family and friends of the late peace activist Rachel Corrie gathered to commemorate the 13th anniversary of her death. Rachel was 29 years old when she was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer while trying to protect a Palestinian home from demolition. At the event in Olympia, one of Rachel's friends, who also witnessed her murder, was a featured speaker. Here's part of the talk given by Alice Coy.
They asked me to start off, or suggested I say, where I went to Gaza to start with. So I'm Jewish and I've got family in Israel, and I'd been to Israel a bunch of times for family occasions, for holidays. I loved it. I saw it as this ideal place. In the UK, I'm a minority as a Jew. Like, the holidays, the weekends, everything's based around like Christianity or something else, and suddenly I was like the majority. And I was very idealistic about it. I thought, well, they've got kibbutzim, it's progressive. So I hadn't seen any other side to it. But back in the UK, I was involved with like the anti-globalization movement and anti-capitalism, anarchism, environmentalism. And on 9/11, I was with there was a large number of us who were attempting to blockade a massive arms fair in London. And we were standing there and we were trying to stop this arms fair from going on and being beaten by the police. And then we heard about 9/11 and we heard about the things. And then we watched with horror and just despair as this war machine started up. And we moved into anti-war direct actions and just doing whatever we could. But it was just, what's going on in the world? How could the world just suddenly get even worse? And I met people who'd been to Palestine with ISM, and this conflicted with my understanding and what I'd seen of Israel. So I thought I should go there and find out for myself what's going on. I need to see it with my own eyes and learn for myself. But I felt uneasy about flying across the world. I mean, another part of the philosophy is, you know, think global, act local. So I'm like, what am I doing? Why should I go across there? Is that the right thing to do? It's another person's people's struggle. This has nothing to do with me. And at this point, a friend of mine who was living in a squat phoned us, and like he did this kind of like he phoned a bunch of us, and he said, "Somebody's come, and they're going to come back tonight with weapons. They're going to attack us." I mean, it's Britain, so it's not going to be guns. But he was scared. He was like, "They've said they're going to come back tonight and attack us. They want us out." And we didn't even think. Like, a bunch of us just immediately, you know, got on the underground and spent an hour crossing London to go and be with him. Because our friend was scared he was going to be attacked that night, and we thought, we'll go and be with him. He shouldn't be on his own. There'll be enough of us. He was absolutely fine, but it got me thinking, like, what's the difference between going across London, going across the road to help somebody, and going across to Palestine to help people? It's just a matter of degree. It's just a matter of quantity. It's not a matter of quality. Why was I even thinking twice about standing alongside those who were being attacked? And so I decided to go. Another question people ask is, why Palestine? I mean, it's usually people who aren't doing anything about anything, right? They're like, why are you not focusing on the homeless? And I'm like, well, I do as well, but like, why are you focusing on the homeless as well? And like, why should one negate the other? People talk about, like, you know, there's problems in Kashmir, which is true. There's problems with homelessness, climate change, Iraq, Native American rights. Why focus on Palestine? And again, I think about it, like, if I see somebody attacked on the street, I'm not going to walk away from them because I can't help everybody that's being attacked in the city that night. I'm going to do whatever I can. I'm going to intervene where I can see need and where I'm asked to help. Like, it doesn't matter that somebody else is being attacked as well. I would just do what, at least I can help the person that's across the road from me or close to me. And if everybody does that, we're going to make the world a better place. And there's a massive need in Palestine. There's this human-made humanitarian crisis going on in Gaza. Like, I was at a refugee camp in Calais. At the moment, there's like a human-made humanitarian crisis going on in Europe as well. And like, there's enough disasters and horrors in the world without war, without borders, without all these things making it worse. Like, the human condition is one of death, of like frustration, of like whatever. Like, but humans are actually like also creating this secondary problem, and that just needs to stop. So there is one in Gaza. There is a horrific situation in Palestine where people and culture and villages and love. I mean, everybody meets people in Gaza who are, a lot of people get deported from the West Bank, Palestinians, and deported into Gaza, and then they're trapped in Gaza. And we met this one guy, and he'd been married, and he just got married, and his wife's in the West Bank. And I don't know if he's ever managed to see her since. You know, he's not in prison, he's just been deported into Gaza. He might as well be put in prison, but the Israelis don't have to own up to the fact that he's in prison. His life's just so easily destroyed by them. Also, as a Jew, I feel a personal connection to the oppression caused by Jewish nationalism. And I just see Zionism as Jewish nationalism, as evil as every other nationalism, and as racist. And disgusting. So that's why I personally am involved. And everybody's got their own reason for being involved in Palestine. I don't think anybody should have to apologize for it or say, like, oh, I'm not anti-Semitic, but like, there's a disgusting thing going on, and people do what they can. People are involved in different issues, and that's great. People should be interested. What was it like to be in Gaza? You feel pretty helpless. The image that kind of came to mind, I felt, was like being poked by this massive, cruel, petty child who was poking us with a stick. And for them, it's just a day at the work. It's just, you know, we don't know what they're going to do next. We can't do anything about it, or we felt we couldn't do anything about it. They can knock down a home, destroy a field of precious food crops, kill somebody. And to them, it's just a day at work, because that's how the occupation is set up. That's how Zionism is set up. That's how the Israeli status set up is so that these people are just, well, it's just my 3 years and I have to go into the army and I'll do all these things and then I'll go to my next job and stuff. But lives are being destroyed because of that. And so it was very overwhelming being there. I mean, it was incredibly overwhelming. It was trying to work out what was going to happen and what we could do about it. We spent a lot of time. One of the most worthwhile things I felt we did was spend days and days and days at this building site where they were rebuilding the water wells that gave water to Rafah, because they'd been destroyed by the army, and we were being human shields, and we spent days there. But it, like, a lot of the time you just didn't really know what to do, and it felt really confusing. But Rachel had some focus throughout all that and throughout the confusion or whatever, and she was, as well as doing the ISM stuff, also working on the Sister City project and making connections with NGOs and local civil society organizations and people. And it was like these two things were going on. I mean, she was 23, and not to be patronizing, but now I look back on us as kids. And yet she was able to kind of understand this was something that needed done. As Cindy was saying, making connections was the most important thing.
That was Alice Coy, who is a friend of the late peace activist Rachel Corey. The full talk by Alice Coy will be aired on KABU this Friday at 9 a.m. on the program One Land, Many Voices.
Portland Community College is becoming the place to be. It's been recognized for promoting the importance of bees to the environment and in working sustainably to make the campus a haven for the endangered pollinators. The college has become only the nation's fourth educational establishment to be designated a bee campus, a project which is the brainchild of Southern Oregon University and Bee City, USA. A college campus pollinator habitat plan will see bee-friendly species planted and nurtured using pollinator-friendly products harmless to bees. The college is already growing herbicide and pesticide-free produce for staff, students, and the wider community in its two learning gardens at the Sylvania and Rock Creek campuses. The initiative emphasizes the importance of sustainable, environmentally friendly working practices in ensuring the survival of key species vital to native plant health. In recent years, biologists have noted sharp declines in bee populations across the country and the wider world.
Eastside Portland Air Coalition will host environmental activist Aaron Brockovich as keynote speaker of a free event open to the community on April 2nd at Revolution Hall from 3 to 7 p.m. In 1993, Brockovich fought a successful legal battle against PG&E due to groundwater contamination from their use of hexavalent chromium. For the first hour of the April 2nd event, advocacy groups, medical and naturopathic doctors, and environmental health consultants will be available to answer questions and give advice to residents dealing with the impact of Portland's air pollution. At 4 p.m., Brockovich will deliver the keynote address followed by an open mic session where people can share stories, ask questions, alongside a panel of citywide advocacy groups, experts, and lawyers. EPAC is a coalition of 3,000 neighbors working together with community groups, businesses, and government agencies to protect air for all Oregonians. The group formed shortly after it was revealed that Portland had toxic air hotspots in virtually every neighborhood.
Families across Portland have been alarmed at the perceived spike in air toxins recently reported in connection to two local small businesses. Jennifer Jones of Eastside Portland Air Quality jumped into this movement over the past few months. Now she's bringing Aaron Brockovich to town April 2nd to talk about why safeguarding our water and air can be a matter of life and death. Jennifer, thanks for joining us here at KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer, how did you first get involved in Eastside Portland Air Quality?
I think like a lot of people, I opened up the newspaper one morning and there was my child's school under that billowy orange toxic hotspot.
What school was that?
Winter Haven and Cleveland. I had kids both my kids actually are out of the school now, but they both went through that system. So 16 years breathing the air.
And what is it about this issue that you think is crucial for people to know?
I think it's really important that people understand that Portland has some of the worst air quality in the nation, and it's the least regulated.
And what has the group been doing, Eastside Portland Air Quality, to get people involved?
So we're Eastside Portland Air Coalition. We have been... Boy, to get people involved has not been a challenge. There have been so many people wanting to be involved. So there are a number of us that are just trying to herd those people into the most productive ways possible. So if you have 5 minutes, we have some 5-minute actions. If you've got an hour, maybe you want to comb through Facebook and tag people for information that they need to get. There is always a place for anybody who wants to be involved.
I was curious because I've been reading a lot about the toxins in the Southeast. Are most of these coming from the glass factory there?
You know, we have a lot of polluters, not the least of which is diesel particulate matter from all sorts of industry. So, yeah, we seem to be really mobilized right now because moss was really tangible for us to see and get behind. But there is polluters just about everywhere you look. We are new to this fight. There have been people fighting this for years and years. The DEQ themselves knew of cadmium in the air up around Tubman School as early as 2005 and didn't do anything about it. So we've been joining our voices and asking how we can support and be supported by the South Portland Air Quality, the Cully Stink Team, the Hayden Island Group, Neighbors for Clean Air. There are a lot of voices in this fight.
When you mentioned DEQ, it also makes me think of EPA. Have they been involved in this?
The EPA has been a little bit involved, but they're a federal regulation and the DEQ regulates us statewide. So there have been some, if you look through our documents on our Facebook page, you'll see that there have been moments where the EPA has come in, but the DEQ has kind of helped some of our polluters write the loopholes that they are now benefiting from and allowing toxics to be in our air.
There seem to be some similarities here to the huge snafu in Flint, Michigan, where the water quality was poisonous, actually, and for many years. And it almost seemed like a cover-up or just mass confusion by government agencies, state agencies.
You know, I really feel like the Flint, Michigan was a really direct, egregious act by one or a handful of politicians and engineers who knew what they were doing when they chose to poison people. What's happening in Portland has been happening for years and years, and a lot of people have turned their backs. I don't know necessarily that there's one person you can say directly made a decision to poison us all, but it's certainly been a combination of effects that have added and accumulated together to create the situation we're in now.
And of the information you've gathered so far, which toxin do you think is the most concerning for Portland?
What to choose? I think the toxics that are, there are 17 hazardous toxics that are used in glass making and identified in diesel. And I think that there's no, that you can't choose. I think that you have to regulate them all.
Now, I would imagine the people who join you probably first go through this very fearful stage. I mean, that's the way I would feel if I was living in this neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like your children went to the school that was in this environment. What do you do at that point before you say get involved? And is there a way to screen yourself to see if you are healthy, if these had a bad effect, the toxins?
There's been some misinformation and some differing information and some health officials that don't want to test because they don't know what to test for, which is one of the reasons that we're having the Aaron Brockovich event. We want to coalesce all of the information into one place so that everybody can bring their questions, maybe bring their urine test results and see how to interpret them in a way that makes sense. We're not trying to fearmonger. We want people to have good information and be able to go forward and live their lives and work for advocacy in our air quality.
So the organization, in other words, is not really just for advocacy, it's also a chance for the neighbors to find out, to get screened
Absolutely.
For health concerns.
Yeah, we are all about supporting, you talk about how can people support us, and we're all about how can we support people. So we have no intention of going in and telling people what to do. We have blind spots. We are only who we are. We only know our polluters. We want to know. We want everybody to join our team and figure out how we can fight this fight together with a diversity of voices so that we can make as big a change as possible. And
and what do you expect or what do you want to see in the long term from this event tonight?
We were just talking yesterday about our, I called it an exit strategy. Somebody else called it our vision, our victory vision. I think that it's important to not just regulate the air right now with a blind spot for what happens to the toxics once they leave the airshed. So I think that toxics need to be regulated from the moment they become something an industry uses to the moment they go into what the landfill, however we just choose to dispose of them. We can't live without industry. We recognize that there are things that we're allowed to do and people we're allowed to save because of the things that we make with toxic materials, but it's irresponsible to use them without a way of making sure that they don't come back into our air, our land, and our water.
Now, given the Aaron Brockovich story, movie with Julia Roberts, and now she's helping you, in the movie at least, and certainly in real life, she met a lot of opposition, and there were certain interests that were involved in trying to cover things up. Are you running into anything like that in Portland?
Some of our members have run into some stuff like that down in South Portland with their polluters, and we've had some run-ins with advocacy groups that support their own artistic industries. But What we are trying to very clearly say, or maybe I should speak personally, what I try to personally say to people is, we love art. I love art. I have a lot of stained glass in my house and I've worked with it in the past. I don't want it to go away if it can be responsibly made. So join our coalition and help us fight for the regulations that can make responsible materials for us all to enjoy.
And how can people support your work and join, in fact?
So you can join our Facebook page. We're the Eastside Portland Air Coalition. You can go to eastsideportlandair.org. You can come to our event tonight at the Clinton Theater. We're screening What's in Our Air from 7 to 9:30. And you can come to our event on April 2nd, and you can meet with everything you said, local advocacy groups, doctors, soil advocates, find out how to bioremediate your soil and what to plant in case you have high nickel or cadmium in your soil. And you can support us by, often support for us looks a lot like being involved in your own neighborhoods and then coming to us and say, this is how you can support us to help make change.
Thanks very much, Jennifer. This is very important work. And again, that's Jennifer Jones joining us live in the studio at KBOO. She's of the Eastside Portland Air Quality Coalition. So I had that wrong here.
That's okay.
Erin Brockovich comes to Portland this Saturday, or actually Saturday, April 2nd, from 3 to 7 p.m. She'll be at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street. And for more, you can go online at www.eastsideportlandair.com. That's all one word, eastsideportlandair.org. Oh, and tonight's event, could we get just a little bit more information on that? Before the Erin Brockovich talk.
It is. Tonight we're screening What's in Our Air at the Clinton Theater from 7 to 9:30.
Is there a charge for that?
There is not.
All right. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with documentary director and producer Jeremy Monroe. He speaks with KBOO reporter Jamie Haddad about his film Upriver, which tells the story of Willamette River conservation efforts throughout Oregon. This will be followed by Labor Radio at 6, of the working class, by the working class, and for the working class. Then at 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Host Mindy Griffiths interviews Portland attorney Leland R. Berger about the effects of marijuana legalization. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, showers and possibly a thunderstorm before 11 p.m., then showers likely. Low around 45. Chance of precipitation is 90%. Tuesday, 50% chance of showers, mostly cloudy with a high near 56. Today in history, in 1960, police fired on black demonstrators in Sharpeville, South Africa, killing some 70 people, an incident known as the Sharpeville Massacre. Between 5,000 and 7,000 people had gathered at Sharpeville Police Station to protest against the pass laws. In 1985, police in Langa, South Africa, opened fire on demonstrators marching to mark the 25th anniversary of the Sharpeville shooting, killing at least 21 demonstrators. The quote of the day is from Stephen Biko, who said, "The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed."
It's 5:28, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In a stunning development, President Barack Obama has had to cancel today's scheduled trip to Capitol Hill, where he intended to make nice with Republican lawmakers. He had planned to drive an ice cream truck to the Capitol and personally serve free ice cream cones to every GOP member, scooping out double dips of each one's favorite flavor, with sprinkles on top. However, in yet another rebuke to the person some members call the illegitimate Kenyan-born Muslim socialist president, The entire Republican caucus pledged that they would neither consider nor vote on eating his cones, dubbing them Obama cream. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sourly declared, "Even though I love Nutty Buddy ice cream, I will not accept anything that Barack Hussein Obama sends to Congress." Adding to the tension, Senator Ted Cruz began a filibuster to shut down the entire government, noting that nowhere in our God-ordained Constitution is the executive branch empowered to hand out ice cream cones. "This is another Obama abomination," Cruz babbled, "and I will stand here like a rock until hell freezes over and the ice cream melts." He added heroically, "If not me, who?" The Koch brothers chimed in that Obama's congressional ice cream scheme is a classic socialist ploy to legitimize government handouts of sweets to everyone as an opium for the masses, inducing them to keep voting for Democrats. And then Representative Trey Gowdy piled on, claiming that the sweet treats for Congress idea might have been sent to Obama in a top-secret email from Hillary Clinton's personal email account. Gowdy demanded that she appear before his congressional committee and admit that her ice cream email was part of the cover-up of her Benghazi scandal. This is Jim Hightower saying, it was just another day of Republicans at play, pretending to be a Congress.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
While numerous U.S. congresspersons are calling for Michigan Governor Rick Snyder's resignation, Snyder is proposing a new action plan to solve the Flint water poisoning crisis. The plan calls for replacing drinking fountains and some lead service supply lines in the city and for increasing education on the dangers of lead poisoning. Area politicians from Genesee County and the city of Flint are calling on the governor to provide millions of dollars for past and ongoing emergency repairs that are threatening to severely damage the county and city's budgets. Commissioners for Genesee County have stated if they don't receive at least $1.1 million in the next few weeks, the county will be forced to lay off more than 20 county employees due to budget shortfalls. Flint is currently replacing the water supply lines to an average of 2 homes per day. Meanwhile, the Flint chief of police told news organizations that the break-in that occurred at the Flint City Hall was definitely an inside job. The break-in occurred in the office where all the original paperwork about the Flint water crisis was stored. More than 3 months after the break-in, police have no suspects and officially say it appears only a television was stolen. The office was ransacked with all the papers and files thrown about the room, making it impossible to know if any documents were stolen. That office was the only office in Flint City Hall to be entered during the break-in.
Peabody Energy disclosed in its most recent U.S. SEC filing that it might declare bankruptcy. The biggest coal mining company on Earth, Peabody stock closed last week at a six-month low after falling almost 50%. Peabody's announcement coincides with a rash of bad news for big coal. Both Arch Coal and Alpha Natural Resources have already filed for bankruptcy, and Foresight Energy, another big producer, said last week they might also go bankrupt. Peabody released a statement saying the price of coal has been stuck at $40 per ton, down from $200 per ton in 2008, as the reason for its possible Chapter 11 filing. Meanwhile, the U.S. Energy Information Administration has reported that natural gas power generation via hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, will likely soon surpass coal for the first time ever on the U.S. power grid.
The U.S. Supreme Court decided today it would not hear challenges against Colorado's regulated marijuana retail program. The justices decided by a vote of 6-2 against hearing the challenges, which were filed by the states of Oklahoma and Nebraska. For more information, KBOO's Doug McVeigh spoke with Mason Tyvert, director of Denver-based Communications for Marijuana Policy Project.
Well, essentially, the attorneys general in these two states filed a lawsuit saying that because Colorado has established a system for regulating the cultivation and sale of marijuana, it has been responsible for some sort of problems that have occurred in Nebraska and Oklahoma, and thus they want the system shut down. The problem is that they did not provide any real evidence of problems occurring or really any evidence to justify their claim that more marijuana was coming into their states. So it was a pretty meritless case to begin with.
Now, as I understand, the states could, in fact, try and file this suit in U.S. District Court. Just because the Supremes decided not to hear it, they could still. Do you expect that they're going to, or what do you see happening moving forward?
I honestly can't speak for the folks behind the lawsuit, so I don't know what their plans might be, but, you know, these lawsuits are really being spearheaded by folks who are anti-marijuana activists and are trying to roll back the progress that's been made in Colorado and other states. And so essentially what we have here is a situation in which folks have lost at the ballot box, they've lost in their legislatures, or they've now lost in the court of public opinion, and they're looking for some sort of legal relief, and in this case, they're not going to get it.
How do you think this will affect other states moving forward?
Well, hopefully this will alleviate some concerns that states might have had about this type of legal activity, but, you know, anyone who looks at the details of this case would really, you know, recognize that it's pretty frivolous. I mean, what we have is a situation in which the state officials in two states are saying they think marijuana is not being controlled, and therefore they want to force another state to stop trying to control it. And it makes no sense, you know. The officials in Nebraska and Oklahoma are saying that they don't like the idea of marijuana being uncontrolled and possibly finding its way into their state, yet the goal of their lawsuit is to shut down perhaps the strongest marijuana control system that's ever been created here in the state of Colorado. So, you know, if anything, I think that what people will learn is that this is not a very good lawsuit to engage in. It's a waste of time and money, and it's unlikely to get you very far.
How has the program been rolling out there in Colorado? How have things been going? Could you give listeners an idea of the what the state's experience has been?
Colorado is really demonstrating that you can regulate marijuana and you can be successful at it. Our state has now been regulating marijuana for the past couple of years with regard to adult sales. When it comes to medical marijuana, it's been doing it for an even longer period of time. And, you know, in the last year or so, we saw hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in marijuana sales take place in legitimate licensed businesses instead of the underground market. There were millions of dollars in tax revenue being paid that previously was being flushed down the toilet. And we're not seeing any sort of significant health or social problems that were predicted. So, you know, for example, the state's chief medical officer, as well as other state and federal officials, have acknowledged that there's been no measurable increase in use among teens or adults in Colorado. There's been no increase in crime or attributed to the use of marijuana or to these marijuana businesses. In fact, these businesses tend to be targeted for crime less frequently than banks. It's really just a system that's working. We're actually seeing marijuana controlled for the first time in history. We know who is selling it, we know where they're selling it and when, and we know that they're asking for ID and that they're not selling it to minors. And the same cannot be said for states like Nebraska and Oklahoma, where it's just a free-for-all.
All right, well, Mason Tvert with the Marijuana Policy Project, one of the authors of Amendment 64. Which legalized marijuana in Colorado. Do you have any final thoughts? And how do people find out more about the work that you're doing?
You know, ultimately, states like Colorado and Oregon and Washington are doing more than any other state when it comes to controlling marijuana, regulating it, making sure that it's only being handled by the people who are supposed to handle it and only finding its way to those people who are supposed to have it. And while no system's going to be perfect, it's certainly a far cry better than prohibition. And we're glad to see that the courts are upholding states like Colorado and Oregon's right to have these systems in place.
Well, again, I've been speaking with Mason Tvert, the Marijuana Policy Project. The Supreme Court today decided not to hear a challenge to Colorado's legal marijuana program, which had been attempted by the states of Nebraska and Oklahoma. Mason, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is Doug McVeigh with KBOO News.
Researchers at Oregon Health and Science University, or OHSU, have developed human antibodies that have the ability to eliminate the HIV virus from newborn monkeys. According to the research published today in the journal Nature Medicine, the human antibodies that they mass-produced in their labs cleared the virus from the monkeys within 2 weeks. Researchers are excited because this is the very first time human antibodies have been administered this way, and there is hope that this can lead to prevent infection in babies and children worldwide. In 2013, more than 200,000 children worldwide were born with HIV, according to UNICEF. One-third of these children die within a year of being born. Half of the children die before their second birthday. They're also hoping that this therapy will be effective in newly infected adults. To make the study possible, researchers had to create a virus that was part HIV, human HIV, and part simian HIV. The newborn monkeys were infected orally, just as human babies become infected during the birth process by swallowing infected secretions from the mother. Within the very first 2 weeks, all of the newborns were completely cured of the HIV, and it never returned, a 100% success rate. Human trials are now underway.
The son of the late music impresario behind UK punk legends, the Sex Pistols, is sending a damning message to organizers of a festival set up to celebrate punk's history. Joe Corey, whose father, Malcolm McLaren, created the band, will burn $5 million worth of his dad's punk memorabilia in protest at the Punk London Festival, which he claims is further evidence that the spirit of the movement has been killed by commercialism. Corey insists any event which has the backing of establishment figures like the Queen cannot embody the punk ethos and is little more than a money-making exercise. The Sex Pistols single, God Save the Queen, caused controversy in the UK when it was released in 1977. Corey will set his bonfire on November 29th in the London borough of Camden, an area of the city which was at the heart of Britain's punk scene in the 70s.
The world's longest Great Barrier coral reef is undergoing rapid bleaching, according to recent underwater surveys. The Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority raised the coral bleaching threat to its highest level, indicating a severe threat to the survival of the reef. Coral bleaching is largely caused by the warming of ocean waters, the acidification of the waters caused by the high level of CO2 in the atmosphere, and runoff pollution from farms and deforestation.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zer, Les Hudson, Jeff Henderson, Rosalind Scott, and Ken Jones. Special thanks to Jamie Haddad. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris hosts the Joe and Abe Talk Radio Show. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Alan Moss speaks on the case for socialism. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on Stage and Studio, host Demay Roberts features actress and author Lauren Weedman talking about her new book, Miss Fortune, fresh perspectives on having it all from someone who is not okay. And at 11:30, on Art Focus, host Andre Middleton interviews Carl Anilon, organ arts professional and painter who has been in the bands Hell Cows, Ape Grave, Plastic Horn Devil, Egg Napper, Old Paint, Jagula, and Hail. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Stay tuned now for an interview with documentary director and producer Jeremy Monroe. He speaks with KBOO reporter Jamie Haddad about his film, Upriver, which tells the story of Willamette River conservation efforts throughout Oregon. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Rosalind. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Upriver tells the story of Willamette River conservation efforts throughout Oregon. Director and producer Jeremy Monroe spoke to KBOO reporter Jamie Haddad about creating the documentary.